The Tom Woods Show, episode 1359.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I got Gene Epstein back with me today. I'm going to set the stage for the episode in just a minute, but I do want to point out that over the weekend, we had a private event at my home where Jordan Page, who was the musician of the Ron Paul Revolution, really, at so many Ron Paul events, he was the opening act, so to speak, and we were at many, many events together over the years. He's been a guest several times on the Tom Woods Show. Jordan did a private concert for members of my supporting listeners group. Now, I didn't want to publicly say, hey, join my supporting listeners group and then come over to my house. I did it kind of the other way. I once people joined, then I invited them. So I do things like this from time to time. If I travel, sometimes I'll get to a city and I'll say, hey, if there are supporting listeners in town, you know, let's go do an escape room or let's do some kind of thing. So that's just an unannounced bonus that's part of being in the supporting listeners group. So thanks to everybody who was there. Seamus Coughlin from the wonderful Freedom Tunes YouTube channel was there. It was just a tremendous night. So join me over at supportinglisteners.com. You never know all the goodies that are going to be in store for you when you get there. Let's see. I want to bring on Gene, but I have this sinking feeling there's something else I want to say. Yeah, I got a bonus episode coming up this weekend. For those of you who are interested in my thoughts on church politics, Catholic church politics, which indeed exist in great abundance, by the way, I've got a bonus episode coming up this weekend. It's a conversation with Roger McCaffrey, who's my favorite person to talk to about this. And if you don't like that topic, see, since it's off the beaten path, that's why I make it into a bonus episode. So if you're not interested in that topic, you don't have to listen to it, but you still get your five episodes. But if that topic does intrigue you, that will be waiting for you over the weekend as a bonus sixth Tom Woods Show episode for this week. All right, let's talk about what Gene Epstein is doing back on the program. We initially planned to have Dan McCarthy back with us. He's the editor at Modern Age. And Dan and Gene had done an episode on this show together in the past where they debated Trump's tariffs. And this time we wanted to have a discussion with the two of them, and well, I guess all three of us, talking about a recent article Dan wrote. Now, Dan has written two recent articles that are somewhat controversial among libertarians, and Dave Smith critiqued one of them on his part of the problem. But the other one is the one we want to talk about here, and that is an article in First Things called A New Conservative Agenda, subtitled A Governing Philosophy for the 21st Century. Well, Dan was not able to make it, and we couldn't reschedule it, and yet I did want to get Gene on. He said he was perfectly all right if we tried him in absentia, so to speak. So that's exactly what we're going to do. You all know Gene Epstein by now, no doubt, recently retired after many years with Barron's, and now directs the Soho Forum, where you can hear debates on timely issues in New York City. And he is also going to be joining us on the Contra Cruise this year, where he'll be moderating a debate between Bob Murphy and me. I'm sure we'll say a little something about that in just a moment. But Gene, welcome back to the show.
Tom, it's great to be back, and I'm looking forward to your joining me when I host the Soho Forum Takes to the Seas en route to Alaska. I hope you'll be there with Bob. And I have a great clunky commercial transition for you to make the next time you're on Contra Krugman with Bob. You know where Bob and I will not be agreeing on the Contra Cruise.
There you go. That's a good one. Yeah.
It's going to work. Anyway.
That is a good one. Yeah. Now, we do have to say, so what Gene is talking about for anybody who somehow has missed it, what we're talking about here is that on the Contra Cruise this year, which is in July, going to Alaska, we are going to have a debate between Bob Murphy and me, and Gene, who moderates debates as the director of the Soho Forum, is and as a special guest of the Contra Cruise, will be moderating that debate. And it's going to be great fun. So you definitely want to sign up at ContraCruise.com. What else was I going to say about us doing this? Well, first of all, it's going to be it'll be a spectacle. I'll put it that way. And I keep saying, but you know, we're going to have to carry Bob's corpse off the ship, and you know, it's way over the top, Gene.
The throngs will be at the Seattle docks when the ship pulls in, because they'll want to see who got his beard shaved. Because I guess the guy gets his beard shaved.
That's right. Who loses? Yeah. The loser has to shave his beard.
They'll all want to know when the ship docks.
But there is one thing people should know, and that is that the long-standing offer whereby all you have to do is go up to Gene and say, Tom Woods, you get a free drink, that does not hold on board the Contra Cruise.
Absolutely. You get a free drink of water, but nothing else.
That's right, because you get a lot of free non-alcoholic drinks, so-called free, on the cruise, but you have your own alcohol packages and it's too complicated. So that will be suspended.
And Tom, I want to talk more about the Contra Cruise, but you're limiting this to 35 minutes, Tom. And I'm going to have to squeeze up my 50 minutes of comments into 35.
Right. Okay. So let's just jump in. Yeah. So in bringing you on, I told everybody about Dan and that we tried to get him on and it just wasn't in the cards, but he was quite willing to do it. And that we're talking about his article, A New Conservative Agenda, that's going to be linked on the show notes page. And this is not the article that Dave Smith critiqued, because Dan has been quite controversial lately. And Dave Smith devoted part of the problem to looking at that one. We're looking at a different one. And it's a long and complicated piece. But I'll just give the most skeletal of outlines. And then Gene, after I do that, you jump in and talk and we'll discuss it. Basically, the long and the short of it is, Dan McCarthy, who was a longtime editor, he's editor at large now of the American Conservative. Now he's editor of Modern Age. He's been in the conservative movement for a long time. He's never really been part of Conservatism, Inc., let's say. He's always been, you know, I would classify more or less as a Buchananite. Mm-hmm. And he's been really, really good on a lot of things and very, very sympathetic to libertarianism. I mean, it would take a long time of, you know, abolishing things before we'd get down to where Dan and I would say, all right, I want to abolish this. And he would say he doesn't. So he's a good, good guy. And also when Gene came on and did a debate with Dan about Trump's tariffs, and that was such a cordial but yet really, really meaty and substantive debate that the two of these gentlemen exchanged very friendly emails afterward about how great it was, and they were both so pleased with it. So Dan's not, you know, of all people, let's not draw horns on his head. Mm-hmm. We're not saying he's a terrible person. We're just saying, you know, he's not infallible, right? Mm-hmm. Ben, who among us is, after all? So the gist of his column is that a lot of conservatives and a lot of Republicans are living in the past. They're living and speaking as if it's the 1980s, and all we need to do is repeat talking points from Ronald Reagan's days. But what Dan is saying is that things have changed. Things have changed in major, major ways. And Gene, I actually had a lot of notes, but if I do that, I'm going to take the whole episode away.
Okay,
so what I'll say is this. What he's saying is that there for a long time in American history, and it took different forms in different periods, there was a kind of class compact where there was a sense that we're all working toward the same goal and everybody has a role to play in America. And there's no sense that one class, or at least there's a muted sense that one class views another absolutely contemptuously, just as some rabble to be ruled over. That there was some kind of a sense that there's a thriving middle class and there's whereas today what we have are, you know, the manufacturing sector, he says, is not what it once was. And he says, yes, I know a lot of that's because of automation, but some of it's because of foreign competition. And this is therefore a self-inflicted wound. The jobs that are replacing the manufacturing jobs, well, yeah, you could be somebody's gardener. You could babysit somebody's kids. But are these the kinds of jobs that you're going to be able to retire on? He's saying that we're splitting into several different classes, and one of them is this overclass, and another one is, you know, like a kind of underclass, and yet another one is a dispensable class, the class of the heartland, of a flyover country, these local economies that have collapsed because of the collapse of some industry or other, and they have nothing to do. They can't be integrated into the economy. So we need to turn away from globalism and from making sure that we maximize the number of widgets produced in the world, and we think instead about the welfare of America and Americans, and that means returning to, and not thinking as a bad word, nationalism. So now, obviously, he has a lot of detail in there, Gene, but now it's our time to unpack some of this.
Well, okay, Tom, okay, by the way, Dan and I had been friends. We'd actually shared a podium at Freedom Fest before we debated. So, in fact, our friendship preceded that debate we had, and of course, has continued since. So, absolutely, he's a great and honest guy, but bear in mind that he does use the T word, tariffs. Tariffs are not an end in themselves, of course. They are a defensive measure and a source of leverage. He endorses tariffs. He states that what we ought to do is minimize the loss of employment due to every factor not technologically inevitable. So bear in mind that he is drawing that line in the sand, and I want to speak to that in a special way. I want to affirm that his brand of nationalism, of America First, helped garner billionaire Ross Perot millions of votes. It helped elect Trump. And by the way, you and I both watch, I think we both have the guilty pleasure of watching that slightly crazy show, Shark Tank, where people pitch their business ventures. I don't know if you know, Tom, how often when the would-be entrepreneur says that he's only going to hire American, the sharks cheer. And so there's lots of sentiment in favor of just buying American. And so when you had me on to address the protectionism of Vox Dei a while back, I made the same point. My point in this case, again, is that Dan is free to start a company called Buy American, a website that would sell consumer goods that are domestically produced and that back ventures that only employ American workers. He might get Ross Perot himself, who's still alive, to back it along with the sharks. I would not participate, mainly because I regard myself as a citizen of the world. And from that position, I observe that the poor people of the world do not reside in the U.S., but in countries like China. And I regard it as an inspiring win-win that stores like Walmart can lift the living standards of Americans by selling them cheap goods made by cheap labor abroad, while also lifting that cheap labor out of grinding $2 a day poverty. So as a libertarian, I would have no right to object to Dan's privately backed by American nationalism, conservatism venture. But what Dan is actually proposing, again, as Vox Dei was, as so many of the protectionists do always, is to use the iron fist of government to force me to buy American against my will. As a flexible libertarian, I will tell Dan that he bears a very heavy burden of proof if he wants to deny my rights in this way. So our disagreement is hardly a level playing field. But even if there were a level playing field between us, Dan's arguments are not convincing. So again, having established that, Tom, and again, it's the sort of thing I want us all to say to socialists and to protectionists. The free market offers you the opportunity to practice your values. Get enough people to agree with you, and you'll become a powerful force in the free market. We might disagree, but we have no right to object to what you're doing, so long as you don't impose the iron fist of government on us. Now, of course, now we can get to the consequentialist side of the argument, and perhaps you want to jump in, Tom, or should I continue?
Well, you want to go? Yeah, I'd like you to continue. I guess
yeah, sure.
There is all this anecdotal evidence that we hear. Like, for instance, what the heck was the name of that book now? I can't remember it. It'll occur to me.
Yeah.
Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, of whom I had on here. And the idea of that book is that there is tremendous dysfunction in much of the heartland and in rural America.
Yeah.
And that, and Dan is kind of touching on this a little bit. And Dan says here that in the old days, you had family and religion to fall back on for comfort. And now you basically, you have drugs and you have people whose lives are just amount to nothing, basically. Mm-hmm. And Dan is telling this as part of a story of a hollowed out economy, where the rich do pretty well, and if you're in a city, you might do pretty well, but the rest of the country really is suffering. Is there really nothing to that?
Well, yes, there is something to that, absolutely. But unfortunately, Dan's version of top-down conservatism, the idea, for example, that tariffs are going to do any good, his mistaken focus on the idea that tariffs help industry and they only hurt consumers. So we consumers, of course, have an obligation to give up on the opportunity to buy from Walmart because Walmart sells so many goods from China. That's bad economics. And so we want to establish the fact that there's really nothing in Dan's proposal for greater top-down control that will do any good, because we know already empirically that Harley-Davidson had to move abroad because of the trade war that Trump touched off. We know that the tariffs that are imposed are so often on industrial inputs like aluminum and steel that make it more difficult for our domestic industries that use steel to operate. And so that's simply not the way to march. And then on top of that, if Dan is talking about something as outrageous as minimizing the loss of employment due to every factor not technologically inevitable, then, by the way, I mean, Don Boudreau, who I think writes some great missives, great letters, had a go at Dan and said, I guess if Americans become less fond of drinking and gambling, then to protect the jobs of brewers, vintners, distillers, liquor store clerks, and poker dealers, Dan would prevent us from reducing our purchases of alcoholic prep beverages and trips to Las Vegas. You know, this does remind me, and I think probably you should put on the show notes page, the essay by Hayek called Why I Am Not a Conservative, because I did think that he makes points that do address Dan, that they essentially are rudderless. They have the conservative impulse. And of course, the conservative impulse is a valuable one. And if I had more time, Tom, within my 35, I'd make the point that really there are lots of ways in which the free market does go conservative, that we want to conserve. We conserve natural resources on the free market. We conserve all kinds of things. And again, as well, I invite Dan to organize a conservative website, Buy American, or Don't Change Your Purchases because you're going to take jobs away from people. Knock yourself out, do it. But the point is that if you give government the power, the blank check to prevent any loss of employment due to any factor that is not technologically inevitable, then you're not going to do those hillbillies in Appalachia any good. You will more than likely do them harm while in the process, of course, violating the rights of the rest of us. So again, I don't think that Dan is marching in the right direction. But to get to your point, I definitely agree that there are concerns about what is happening in the U.S. economy. I do stress, however, that when Dan talks about how the only service sector jobs, by the way, amazingly, are now paying slightly more than manufacturing jobs, although that's probably due to things that I don't welcome. It's probably due to the minimum wage laws that's probably cut off service sector jobs that pay very little. So that's not been a good thing. But the ways in which we libertarians want to address that problem, a few things that are fairly obvious are the awful circumstance in which high-paid, high-productivity jobs in places like San Francisco and New York, which are plentiful and pay well, are not available to people because of zoning restrictions, local regulations that make it hard to build, rent control that misallocates housing. That's a free market solution that would enable and encourage job mobility. We want to abolish the minimum wage laws because we don't want job opportunities for the low skilled to dry up. It is, by the way, a very good econ talk from Russ Roberts just in the past week, showing clearly that the minimum wage hikes in Seattle have had the effect of eliminating low skilled work in Seattle. So we want to abolish restrictive licensure on all levels so that people can have greater mobility to shift work. 35% of jobs are restrictively licensed. And by the way, restrictive licensure, of course, should be listed. By restrictive licensure, I mean that you have to undergo expensive training in order to become a manicurist or a cosmetologist, or indeed to become a divorce lawyer. I think women who live in poor areas can learn divorce law on the job and deliver divorces to other women. All of those ways of liberating the labor markets are on our agenda as libertarians. And unfortunately, Dan is tone deaf to those solutions. Now, of course, I also want to emphasize that for the workforce, we have more people. Now, I get on the horns of a dilemma, Tom, because I see data. I've been covering the data for a quarter of a century, and I see data that contradict the arguments of some of my fellow libertarians that everything is going to hell. I basically conclude that the evils of state-controlled capitalism, the evils of crony capitalism are not ultimately dominant, because I do see progress. I do find that the share of output that's going to labor is pretty much within the normal range. I make that statement because the Wall Street Journal just a week ago had a very poorly conceived statistical measure that parroted the myth that the share going to labor has declined. I do find that if you apply, this is where you get into real arguments, if you apply just the personal consumption expenditures inflator used in the national income counts for consumer spending and apply it to any measure of wages, you find that average hourly wages are at a record high in real terms. So that's contrary to what Dan states. Dan talks about how contract work has taken off, and that was repudiated just a year ago by the Bureau of Labor Statistics when they finally looked into it and they found that contract non-traditional labor is actually down percentage-wise from 13 years ago. So again, so many myths are perpetrated about what's going on. I do, of course, insist on saying that those who work, those who have jobs, are doing better than ever, although I also insist that they could be doing far better. We could be doubling output every 10 years if we only liberated the free market in the way that libertarians want us to. So again, just to sum up briefly, the hillbilly elegy message is valid. There are a lot of things we can do about it. I haven't gotten to the most draconian things, such as the point that's made by Charles Murray, the explosion in disability payments by government that has encouraged so many people in the workforce not to work. The labor force participation rate is way down, and it's clearly, in my view, attributable to the welfare state and attributable to various ways in which the welfare state makes it hard for people on welfare to get off it because of what is referred to as the fiscal cliff, where you fall, meaning that if you get a job, then you not only you lose your benefits and the pay you get is like only 98 or 95 cents of the benefits you lost, so that your marginal tax rate is 105% if you take a job. All of those things that free market conservatives and free market libertarians are urging should be tops on the agenda of people like our friend Dan McCarthy.
I'm going to read one sentence, though. I still have to push a little bit on this because I feel like if I were to ask the average person, that person might say, I don't know all the statistics that Gene Epstein knows. I just know what I see. And they would echo what he says. And here's what Dan says. Okay. A family wage, lifelong work, retirement guarantees, and brighter prospects for one's children and grandchildren are not part of the bargain anymore. Is that just false?
Look, you'll hear it from Tucker Carlson. You know, obviously these things, you know, to use that, you know, that's now term of art these days, these things metastasize. You know, I mean, God, if Tucker Carlson is saying it on Fox News, and if the New York Times is saying it, and now the Wall Street Journal starts echoing it, then who blames Dan McCarthy for repeating the same point? As I said, Dan talks about echoes of the myth that was being perpetrated in the media that people are engaging in these non-traditional work deals that aren't advantageous. And even the New York Times backed off from that one. But again, I guess, Tom, by the way, I want to mention, you had me on about 6 months ago talking about an article I'd written at the time for Reason about this. And I'm coming out with more on this. I did find, by the way, in the show notes page, objection after objection from your audience. And I realized, my God, I would love to come back on your show and deal with those objections and try to send people in the show notes page the proper numbers. And in fact, I'm working on an article right now that builds from that Wall Street Journal chart, and then and I show that all you have to do is, I mean, I don't know if I could take a moment to explain this, Tom, but there's something that's happened to the U.S. economy that a lot of people don't know. It's not really a good thing. Depreciation of capital has accelerated. Depreciation is taking double the bite out of output that it used to, because we're no longer investing in structures that last a long time. We're increasingly investing in equipment and software, which depreciates very quickly. So once you make all of the enormous allotment for depreciation that's right in the national income accounts, then you have the base from which labor can be paid and from which profit can be earned. And once you do that, just that one stroke, then you find that labor's share is within the range of the past. So I don't know if that was too quick for somebody, but the fundamental mistake that economists are making is that net domestic product, net domestic income is actually the only valid measure, and that's net after depreciation. And its share of gross domestic product has declined. That's what's happened to the U.S. economy, and that's actually, in a nutshell, the fundamental reason why people are getting the wrong impression by putting up gross domestic product and gross domestic income that labor is getting a lower share, because in fact, there is less to go around proportionally because of that net figure. So I know you've almost made it necessary to get into that, Tom, in order to say that, yeah, you have to take a close look at the numbers in order to recognize that none of these things are true. And then, of course, otherwise, I guess you do have to get into arguments about measures of inflation, because the reality of the free market is that incomes are lifted, not on the wage side or the salary side so much, but on the supply side. And of course, if you look at any of just the standard breakdowns of how we live now, of the houses we live in, the things we own, the things we buy versus what we bought 30, 40 years ago, then that alone as well, if you strip away the numbers, shows that virtually everybody lives better than they used to. And of course, Don Boudreau likes to point out that if you actually look at those goods and services that in that sense that we buy versus what Bill Gates can buy, the actually inequality has in that sense, in a subjective Austrian sense, has probably narrowed because 40 to 50% of people in poverty own cars, have air conditioners, have all the things that Bill Gates takes for granted. Half the people in poverty take those things for granted. They just have to live in smaller homes, even though something like 40% of them in poverty own their own home, although it's definitely smaller than Bill Gates's home. That's for sure. But in any case, I got off on that, and I wasn't prepared to give you a complete dissertation, but hopefully that touches a little bit on it. You know, I wanted to mention one other thing, Tom. You threw at me the question, that standard thing, you know, Americans don't make things anymore. And I was inspired to do my little calculation because Dave Smith repeated that in his great stand-up act. And do you know that if you add up the number of workers today directly engaged in making or maintaining tangible things in the U.S., that's manufactured goods, that's structures, construction, of course, of all things. That's mined materials, like fracking from oil or other things that we mine, like coal. Or food, of course. We grow food. We prepare food in kitchens. All of those tangible things that people are engaged in. And, of course, people are engaged in putting new parts into those things. Then nearly one in four private sector workers in the U.S. is still making something.
Now, Gene, I don't normally do this, but because you prepared a lot for this particular episode, I'm now going to actually just say to you, Gene, talk about whatever you want. I've never done that before.
Okay. Well, I mean, let me see. My God, Tom, you know, you have promises to keep, and I guess we probably just want to emphasize again that I'm not here to celebrate what has been going on in the U.S. economy. Because I think that if you just do a simple mental experiment and just take the minarchist state, just take a complete rollback, the libertarian, white night watchman state, and then imagine that all of that creativity that goes into figuring out how to evade the tax laws, all of that creativity goes into entrepreneurship, we could double output every year. But so therefore, I do want to emphasize, and did I say double output every year? No, double output every 10 years, because we could easily go to 7% growth. We've even had 7% growth. But so therefore, I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of Pollyanna about about all that goes on. I only want to say, look, if you look at the facts, many of our libertarian brothers, and Dan Smith included, are singing a dirge. Well, Dan says, getting back to something else Dan said, Dan paints his picture in which the only thing you can do in the service economy is like dog walking, although ironically, he talks about serving meals in restaurants. Now, admittedly, I'm in New York and I go to steak joints and I splurge. And in many cases, I know that the waiters in these steak joints could be earning more money than I earn. So even the profession that Dan mentions, is serving meals in restaurants, can often pay well. And obviously, if you get a job at McDonald's, you get a job in the kitchen, in a restaurant, or you're a busboy and you bus tables, then there is a job ladder. You know, you can become manager, supervisor. You know, when Barbara Ehrenreich and Nickleton dimed, you know, that left-wing track about how supposedly the poor are trapped in jobs that get them nowhere. And she was oddly noticing that the supervisors she hated used to have her job. So the idea that the service sector economy offers you no potential to earn a decent wage and support a family, that's just ludicrous. I mean, there are lots of lower. I mean, if you're simply a nurse's aide in a hospital, then you're earning something decent. I mean, an awful lot of course, low-skilled service jobs are in, of course, the huge medical care industry. So again, that's a myth that there's no potential to get anywhere. But what is the more limited free market agenda? Roll back zoning restrictions and other policies that make housing unaffordable, so that people can move to areas like New York and San Francisco without paying enormous amounts in rent. Make people aware of that. And to some degree, that's beginning to happen. By the way, I think it was in Minneapolis that they're beginning to do that. Abolish restrictive licensure. We have a lot of free market friends who see that evil. Ed Glaser makes the point that we're making it more difficult for a poor person to start some sort of bodega in the Bronx, all the licensing restrictions he's got and hurdles he's got to go through, than for a richer kid to start some software firm. Abolish the drug laws so that hundreds of thousands of black men, as it's often been pointed out, black people, of course, ought to especially support that, because so many of young black youth are being jailed for selling drugs, who are committed or not accused or convicted of committing anything violent, of committing violent crimes. The more limitedly, of course, this is more debatable among libertarians. Some people like charter schools, others don't. But obviously, the black voters want charter schools that teach them more the basic literacy. Of course, you and I favor the idea of Brian Kaplan, which is that we really ought to roll back the multi-trillion-dollar school state and roll back credentialism of also, and in that way we would be greatly helping the poor. So a poor kid might be able to apply to medical school at the age of 13 rather than go through all the hurdles of going through high school and college in order to get into medical school and then deal with the welfare cliffs. Enormous things that could be done to enhance the living standards of those people that Dan and you and I are concerned about.
I guess the message that keeps coming through the article is that with the decline of manufacturing, there just aren't jobs that are decent for these people. That's the thing. So that even if we tinker with tax policy and stuff, there's no way to integrate these people. And so he says that the old welfare state kind of took for granted that this is a little help when you need it, but basically you're going to be part of the society. He says now we have palliative liberalism, which is basically an attempt to humanely euthanize a bunch of no longer necessary people. I mean, that's a really grim way of looking at things.
Okay, yes, Tom. It's been true for decades. And by the way, not at all surprising to an economist who understands how productivity gains get spread in the free market, that service sector jobs, on average, pay about as well as manufacturing jobs. Unfortunately, that might be. I wonder if half your listeners understand. Why? You know, oddly enough, if you actually are going to tell a striking story about what happens when a machine makes somebody more productive. I know, you know, by the way, you mentioned about your dad, and in a way, Tom, I'd have to fault you because, you know, oddly, you almost might say that when machinery makes a particular industry more productive, the benefits benefits, almost most of the benefits, more likely go to people who don't work in that industry. Because, of course, mainly, of course, because of the goods and services that flow out because of that enormous productivity. That's what happened to farming. So, again, I digress. I'm only saying that there's nothing surprising in the fact that service sector jobs, on average, pay about the same. And now, amazingly, I'm finding the Bureau of Labor Statistics is reporting that the average wage in service sector jobs is more, pays more. But more importantly, it's exasperating that people like Dan don't recognize what Barbara Ehrenreich, the left winger, reported, although she didn't notice it either, that the supervisors she hated had worked in her positions. Supervisors who then are earning decent wages that can support it. Supervisors, I mean, mainly in restaurants where she did her low wage work. That if you're working in a hospital, you can become a super, you learn the job, you work your way up. There are all kinds of job for people who don't even have a high school diploma or just graduate from high school, that it's very possible to work in construction jobs, by the way, pay more than service sector jobs on average, pay more than manufacturing jobs. There's a lot of construction that goes on. We do make a lot of stuff. So if you look at any service or in retail, there are, interestingly enough, by the way, there's the same number of retail jobs as there were about 7 years ago. In other words, what's interesting, retail bricks and mortar jobs, I mean, even though Amazon has made a huge difference and that what's happened is that they're about flat. Of course, there should have been growth, but they're about flat. So there are millions of retail jobs. Now, those entry level jobs in retailing do not pay a whole lot. But again, there is a job ladder. If I spoke to a low-skilled person, I would say, and that person was looking for job opportunities, I would say, get an entry-level job with Walmart. If you get experience at Walmart, and if you do well, you can climb the ladder. I would say that especially to women, because, of course, women often have the best sense because the consumer at places like Walmart and otherwise usually are women. So the service sector offers enormous opportunities to earn a decent living doing something productive apart from the manufacturing sector, even though, of course, we still manufacture more than ever, but with many fewer workers, that's basically a good thing. But as I said, if you want to make something, then you can work in a kitchen. Of course, you can work on the farm. I wouldn't tell you that. You can. By the way, in addition, I'm sorry, I'm almost sputtering. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports on job openings. And do you know that for the first time in history since the data, of course, the data only go back to 2001, but there are now more job openings than there are unemployed people, are officially unemployed people. That's for the first time since the data had been run. That's actually just a sorry commentary on the fact that fewer people are looking for jobs, mainly. And also, of course, there is a somewhat poor fit. But if you break it down, there are jobs available in retailing, jobs available in the healthcare sector. All of those jobs offer potential. They are not dead-end jobs. Any service sector job you want to choose, take somebody in that profession right now, working for the service, working for the restaurant, or working for the hospital, or what have you. And those people probably used to have your job, because the most valuable job training is, of course, training on the job.
Gene, you have been heroic in sticking to my arbitrary time limit today. So we're gonna wrap it up there and
enjoy the concert, Tom. You're incredible. You're putting on a concert in your home tonight.
That's right. It's for if you folks who are supporting listeners of the show already know about it. It's a private event with Jordan Page for supporting listeners at my house. By the time you hear this, actually, Gene, it will already have.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Have passed. Yeah.
Okay, but just a moment. On March 18th, that's a week from this Monday. Oh, excuse me. Now I'm speaking in the wrong time. I think this is going to be aired when I've just done with you before March 18th. Monday, March 18th, the Soho Forum will be having an historic debate on Israel versus Palestine, Israeli-Palestine relations, pro and con. The resolution is essentially, I would have to say, a hawkish view, of a hawkish pro-Israeli government view. It's going to be, the negative is going to be taken by Major Danny Surzin. He's going to oppose that hawkish view. Major Danny Surzin, who's actually served in Iraq and Afghanistan and has been writing some superb articles on foreign policy, and he's going to be opposing that resolution. And that will be on the Israel-Palestine conflict on Monday, March 18th, at the SOA Forum in New York. So, and again, a free drink at the bar from me if you come up to me and you say the words, Tom Woods.
I will point out, by the way, that there is a small contingent of the Tom Woods Show elite that are going to New York for that event.
Planning to bust the budget of the SOA Forum by saying the name Tom Woods in unison, I invite them to do so.
That's okay. Very good. Very good. I wish I could make it. Unfortunately, my schedule doesn't allow that. I love getting to that SOHO Forum, and I will get up there again as soon as I possibly can. Well, thanks again, Gene. Always great to talk to you. And if you want more Gene Epstein, of course you can, you know, listen to previous episodes with Gene. But obviously, yes, I mean, Gene, what do you think would be the more obvious way to get more Gene Epstein?
Oh, yes. More obvious way would be to come when the SOHO Forum takes to the seas, otherwise known as the Contra Cruise.
There you go, Gene. All right. You didn't let me down. ContraCruise.com. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, before we wrap up today, you know how I help folks out if you get your web hosting through my link. Well, then I'll give you the very thing that you're hungriest for, which is people to actually visit your website or blog. That's the thing. You don't want tumbleweeds rolling by. You want actual people. Plus, I have a bloggers group where we help each other out and a lot of great benefits. And these are all free as long as you get your Bluehost hosting through me and you get a good deal too. So it's all super duper. Well, anyway, I got a fellow with a very, very niche market, but I like this niche market because it sounds lucrative to me. He does B2B copywriting. That's business-to-business copywriting. Copywriting, of course, not meaning intellectual property. Copywriting, C-O-P-Y-W-R-I-T-I-N-G. He writes advertising copy or email copy, that sort of thing. In other words, words that sell. That's what copywriting is. And I don't know how he got this domain name. I don't know how this was available. It's yeswords.com. Yeswords.com. How did he get that? That's worthy of Woods. That, you know, I pride myself on getting these domain names. People say, how was that available? I don't know how yeswords.com was available, but it's beautiful. He focuses on business-to-business copywriting for the advanced materials industry, such as alloys, polymers, and the like. He has the scientific knowledge and the marketing skill to be able to help businesses in that field. So if that is of interest to you, then check out yeswords.com because he will help you. You specialize in the business. He specializes in the promotion. It's a great combination. So check out yeswords.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1359 as well. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free. And we'll see you next time.